find the defendants incredibly guilty.
Find this ultimate chicken sandwich on brioche bun to be guilty of being delicious.
Right.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Say.
You break, we're both lawyers.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 274. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, sir?
I am doing fantastic. I'm really, really excited about today's show.
Me too. I can't wait to speak to somebody who finally, we get a real lawyer on here who's actually argued in front of the Supreme Court. I'm so tired of working with armatures on this show. But no, just teasing, Andrew. but nonetheless, still very excited to talk to Monica Miller. That'll be in just a minute. Well, actually, no, I guess we don't have any announcements or anything, right? Other than just, that's my,
I cannot be contained. We can't wait any longer.
Yeah, we can't wait. There's nothing to announce. Let's get right on over to our interview with Monica Miller. And welcome Monica Miller to the show. Monica, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, we are still waiting with bated breath to see whether or not we ace that last bar question. We'll find out later in today's episode. But for now, let's talk about, well, there's a lot to talk about. Of course, reminding everyone, you are a senior counsel at the American Humanist Association. You've recently argued before the Supreme Court, which is super cool. That's amazing. How many beers did you have to drink with Kavanaugh? Is that part of it?
I had zero beers with Kavanaugh, but okay. I had a lot of vodka sodas afterwards.
That is a fantastic answer. So, Andrew, why don't you let us know where should we begin in this conversation? Do we want to do some background? Do we want to do some, or do we want to get right into the Supreme Court level questions?
Yeah, I think we talked about this. We talked about Monica's case, which is captioned the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission versus American Humanist Association. That is over the 40-foot-tall cross
right
in Bladensburg, Maryland. We talked about that in episode 256. So if you want to get into all of the minutiae of the facts of the case, we had Sarah Henry on, who was just fantastic, and described kind of, you know, the state of the monument and the history and some of the factual misrepresentations.
I remember it was that really difficult question of whether a 40-foot tall cross has anything to do with religion,
right?
Was it something like that? Is that roughly it, Andrew? Was that
yes, how that went? Yes, that you have it. And it, admittedly, you know, one of the things that you know, both Monica and I learned in law school is that there's kind of an aphorism that law professors hand down where they say, you know, only hard questions go to the Supreme Court, and this puts a lie to that, right? Because this is a transparently easy question. But why don't talk about, Monica, like how AHA came to be involved in this case, like sort of the you know, what went into the selection, you know, your kind of your initial evaluation, all of that stuff.
Sure. So we had several local citizens approach us about it after, I think it was around the time that we had sent out a letter for another cross, and maybe around the time we even prevailed in that case. It was a smaller cross in Lake Elsinore, California. And we had some people that were members, and they said, you know, there's actually a giant cross in this intersection in Prince George's County, Maryland. So we took a look into it. We sent the government a letter saying, look, we think this is on government property. I mean, it's a highway median after all. But we thought maybe there's a chance that this is actually private land and no problem. But they confirmed it was definitely government land. We found out that the government had invested a ton of taxpayer dollars into this. I think it was $100,000 in 1980s, and then they've been continuing to spend money on routine maintenance, and then they just set aside another $100,000 for like some substantial renovations. So there was a lot of government control and funding into this, you know, giant Christian edifice. So when we sent the letter, we said, you know, we can avoid litigation. You just move the cross to a church or to American Legion's property, somewhere that's not government owned. You know, they've already spent the money on it, but we're not even asking them to, you know, refund taxpayers. Just get rid of it now. They refused to do so. So we really had no choice but to bring it to court. And the reason we took this case to court was because it was, you know, we looked at all of the circuit court cases. Every court that involved, or every case that involved a cross memorial, you know, like used for a war memorial, had been found unconstitutional. Basically, every cross that had been on government land had been found unconstitutional, except for like two kind of weird outliers that, like, one of them was, you know, this sort of integrated city seal, and the other one was also a city seal. So, and we're talking like 30 cases or something. So we brought this to court, and we thought, you know, there's very little chance we're going to lose. And we actually did lose in the district court, kind of on the basis that it was more secular, you know, non-religious. It was more non-religious than it was religious, which we just thought was ridiculous. And so we took the case to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and won on the grounds that it is definitely more Christian and more religious than it is secular, which really isn't even the test. But that's kind of how they flipped the test into looking at it. So we did win. And then by the time, you know, this gets up to the Supreme Court, it was really out of our hands. The Supreme Court had changed a little. You know, we had won. And you know, from the optics of it, it's not the kind of case, you know, we were talking about the kind of cases the Supreme Court takes. Not only is this so obviously a Christian symbol, but because there's no circuit split, like I said, every court that had decided a case involving a war memorial cross or a cross-shaped monument on government land had found it unconstitutional. So there was no real circuit split here. And those are the usually the cases that the court takes, is when half the courts go one way and then half the other go the other way. You want to sort of create this uniformity in the federal court system. So we didn't even have that. So even when we, you know, Kavanaugh had already just, you know, taken the bench, we were waiting to hear back from the cert petition. The odds didn't look favorable that they would take the case. And unfortunately, they did. So yeah, that's how we landed in the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So I totally appreciate that explanation on the split among the circuits, which is, I think you did a nice job of really explaining like why, when it's important for the Supreme Court to step in versus, you know, when some might say a court is engaged in more activism to try and overtly overturn existing laws, which I want to ask you about. I was really, really troubled by the argument advanced by the American Legion in this case, right? Because the American Legion explicitly says that that this court should overrule Lemon versus Kurtzman, right? Should get rid of 45 years, I'm sorry, should get rid of, 38 years of Supreme Court precedent that, you know, of, in fact, I'm going to ask you as a sidebar your views on the Lemon test, because it's, you know, that's controversial among lawyers. But I feel pretty confident that I know what your answer will be as to whether the Lemon test should be overruled and replaced with the coercion standard that the American Legion was advocating in the Supreme Court. Talk to me a little bit about that argument and about how you decided to approach that, knowing, you know, that you're in hostile territory, right?
Yeah.
That you're in front of a deeply conservative court that has, you know, five members who have explicitly written as to an accommodationist view of the Establishment Clause, right? The idea that the Supreme Court can generally, consistent with the First Amendment, uphold federal and state legislation that prefers religion to irreligion, right?
Yeah.
And that's the accommodationist view. So I think I gave you a lot to chew on there. So I'll step back now.
Yeah. So, I mean, starting with my views on Lemon. So Lemon was decided in the 1970s. But I actually, and I mentioned this in my oral argument, it's not the Lemon test is really just a synthesis of what the law was before. So really, when you look at the court's first Supreme Court case, really interpreting the Establishment Clause was Everson, and that was 1947. The court is already laying out the groundwork then. So when you talk about overturning Lemon, you're really talking about overturning the entirety of the Supreme Court's Establishment Clause jurisprudence, starting from the 1940s. And that case laid a very broad test. It said, you know, the government can't aid religion. It can't prefer one religion over another religion or religion over non-religion, meaning you can't prefer, you know, God over atheism and that kind of thing, God belief. So you get, after that case, a couple of cases saying, you know, in order to determine whether the Establishment Clause is violated, we look at whether the purpose is secular and whether the effect is, you know, secular or religious. So long before they called it the Lemon test, they had this purpose and effect analysis. It was very uncontroversial. The courts were applying this test 8-1 in decision after decision. No one challenged this as a valid way to look at Establishment Clause cases. Then in the 1970s, you get the Lemon test. That was, again, I think it was an 8-1 or 7-2 decision. Very non-controversial, very, you know, this is the test. And that continued for, you know, maybe 10 to 15 years, and no one had any issue with it. And then you start getting Rehnquist making these sort of critical statements about Lemon and about the idea that the government should be allowed to prefer even religion over non-religion. He says you can't prefer one religion to another. But so this idea of the Lemon test being out of step with the Establishment Clause is complete lie. It is the law. And so when we're talking about overruling Lemon, like I said, we're really talking about overruling what we know of today as separation of church and state, and what we've always known as separation of church and state kind of in this country. So with respect to replacing it with a coercion test, that's never been the test. The courts have been equally critical. The court, you know, various Supreme Court majorities have been very critical of this idea of coercion as being very under-inclusive. There's many government actions that we would say they're not coercive, but they are certainly proselytizing or advancing religion in a way that is, you know, violate separation of church and state. So yeah, I mean, we're definitely scared that argument will have some traction. I'm cautiously optimistic that Roberts and even Gorsuch were not completely sold on the defendants and the American Legion's argument that coercion is the best replacement test. And they didn't actually come forward with any other good replacement test. And I think that's actually a testament to Lemon being the best test, because it's endured through the years. It's received a little bit of criticism, but the criticism isn't with Lemon. It's with the results of cases that applied Lemon. There's many cases that applied Lemon that upheld government action. So it's a little bit bizarre that they have such a, you know, animosity towards a test that yields quite consistent results. I mean, sometimes things are unconstitutional, sometimes they are, but you can actually find a common thread in those decisions either by looking at who's the judges or just by looking at, you know, what the display is or what the action is.
Can I ask a layperson, if you don't mind, this might sound like a stupid question, but why isn't it? This is just so hard for me to understand, I guess, as maybe it's because I'm an atheist. Mm-hmm. Why isn't it that the entire argument is you walk into the Supreme Court oral argument time, and then you just hold out a photoshopped Islamic crescent, 40-foot size, between the freeway overpass or whatever, and say, look at this and tell me how you'd feel about this. I rest my case. I'll take my answer off the air, and then you leave.
Yeah.
Why is that not just obviously enough? I don't understand.
We've definitely made that argument before, and it's definitely one that sometimes appeals to audience members that can't quite see it the other way around.
Yeah.
I think the justices just know that the likelihood of a government in our country doing that, you know, putting up a giant star and crescent and calling it a day and saying this is our war memorial for everyone is so unlikely that it's not an argument that these justices see as a real threat. I think that you have to look at it from the lens that these are, you know, at least 3 or 4 of the justices on this court want the cross to remain. So they're going to try to find a way to keep it that way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, making that argument helps explain it to sort of lay people that are, you know, what's the big deal with the cross? Well, you know, if you're a Christian and you put up a star crescent, you wouldn't like that. They kind of get it. But these justices are a little bit more, I don't want to say advanced, but they're just looking at it differently. And they realize the power that they have to sort of uphold the cross. And, you know, they might say, well, no more after this, you know, this one's old. But I think that they are not going to, I don't know, look at that argument as a serious floodgates kind of concern.
Well, so, but sorry, I don't mean it as a floodgates thing. It's more explain to me the difference. Yeah. You know, like, could somebody possibly, am I wrong? Like, aren't those functionally equivalent except all it does is try to illustrate the bias that they have. Like, oh, okay, when it's a different symbol, I see that I'm actually smuggling in some Christian values to something that, you know, isn't, that I thought was neutral.
Oh, 100%.
You know,
but
so you're just saying it's like they kind of know that they can get away with that and they aren't going to respond well to that argument.
Yes, that, and there's also the, there's also the other argument that was made that is also, for lack of a better word, bullshit, but is they're talking about World War One and how World War One is closely associated with the Latin cross, because when we buried our soldiers overseas, the European governments put up crosses over the war dead. But the Jewish war veterans came in and they said, you cannot put a cross over our graves. You have to use the, you know, Star of David. And so they made an exception for Jews. They put up Stars of David. And when they didn't know a soldier's religion, they would try to put up crosses and stars proportional to the sort of the numbers that the Jewish war welfare board was giving them. And then, of course, Christians got mad that once, you know, they found out who was buried under there, if they weren't Jewish, Christians were mad that they were being misaligned, you know, with the wrong religious symbol. Mm. And we're kind of like, yeah, that's the point. Like, that's how a lot of Jewish people or Muslim people feel, atheists, of course,
yeah,
when you're saying this giant Christian cross is their war memorial. So, yeah, it's a little bit different because, you know, they didn't use star and crescents for U.S. soldiers in World War One. They did have Europe, I think it was France and England, both had a specific tombstone for Muslim war dead. So they were actually a little bit more diverse in terms of their options than we were. We only had the Star of David and the cross. But yeah, so it's just one of those arguments that is that they would just kind of throw back and say, well, they didn't use that in World War One, and this is World War One. So.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Ottomans might have, but yeah.
Yeah.
So, Monica, you had mentioned that obviously you targeted Chief Justice Roberts as the, quote, swing justice, mm-hmm. even though that's that moves the fulcrum pretty far to the right.
Yeah.
You'd mentioned that you'd also targeted Justice Gorsuch. Talk to me about how you came to that decision.
Well, I wouldn't say I targeted him, but all I was sort of saying is that during the oral argument, he was kind of begging the other side to, you know, the defendants to give him a test that he could replace with Lemon. Because, you know, if you read his circuit decisions, he seems to be very in the camp of get rid of Lemon. And he made that pretty apparent in oral argument. But he also could not, at least from the oral argument, seem to grasp what he would replace it with. And he said, give me something to replace it with. And he didn't like what they were giving him. So that's kind of why I say he was more in our camp. But I think as far as the justices, you know, that I think are, if we are to win narrowly or lose narrowly or win narrowly, it would be because of Roberts. And, you know, even maybe even Kavanaugh, when you read some of his circuit decisions, I mean, we know he's most likely not going to be on our side, but he actually out the gate asked the defendants, well, what about the Jewish war veterans? And he seemed, you know, pretty sensitive to the non-Christian minority in asking some of his questions. Now that can just be posturing, who knows, but at least he was not looking at it the same way or asking questions the same way that Gorsuch was, which was, how do we get rid of Lemon? He was more like, well, we have this other problem. It's not the test, it's the fact that you're still saying that there's a giant Christian cross that's supposed to be representing everyone, and it clearly doesn't. So at least I have him understanding that basic premise, because I don't know if Gorsuch, for instance, accepts that premise that the cross can't represent everyone. I know Justice Scalia, in a similar oral argument about a war memorial cross in the Mojave Desert, seemed to agree with the government's argument in that case that the cross represents everyone, and kind of made a snarky remark to the attorney when he said that it doesn't represent Jews. Scalia said, what do you mean the cross doesn't represent Jews? And it was like, and people laughed in the courtroom. And then that kind of point did not make its way into Justice Scalia's dissent or concurrence. It was kind of a weird opinion, but because I think he realized how bogus that was to assume that the cross represents everyone. But anyways, my point is that I think that Gorsuch, I could see him going in that Scalia direction of saying that and whatnot. But I think that the bigger problem is trying to assert that this cross represents everyone. And that's the government's argument here.
My point is that you are on the air openly pining for the return of Antonin Scalia. Yeah. Did you lose a bet? Or?
No. Yeah. It's fine that he's not here.
Yeah, take a shower after that. I think this has never come up on the show. I just realized, Andrew, I've never asked this question, or maybe you've answered it and I don't remember. But when you talk about Gorsuch wanting the other side to come up with like a replacement for Lemon, I guess I was under the impression that these justices could just do that themselves. Is there some reason? Do they need, if they're going to come up with something like a Lemon test, mm-hmm. but a different kind of test, does it have to be something that was argued by one side, or do they have the license as a Supreme Court justice to kind of just come up with something and make it work?
Yes, they definitely can do that. And they've tried. I think Justice O'Connor had this sort of hybrid test that she was always pushing for that I don't think any independent counsel sort of came up with it to her. Mm. But I think the point is that, you know, our job as lawyers really is to kind of educate the court and give them the law, because they are so busy and have their other cases. And so we're sort of advocates to kind of shape and mold the law. And so I think part of it is that no one can come up with a better replacement test that accurately reflects the goals of the founding fathers, that accurately will, maintain separation of church and state, and is, you know, not going to overturn decades of precedent. And so I feel like he's kind of looking for something that doesn't exist. And he's like, come on, if you want me to take this dramatic step, you got to give me something good. And he was not satisfied with what they were giving him. Now, maybe he'll try to come up with something on his own. Maybe he'll just end up buying the coercion test after all. But that's kind of what it is. I mean, certainly they're the Supreme Court. They can really do whatever they want with respect to making a test and overruling precedent. Yeah.
Yeah. And since we've been kind of talking about, on the optimistic side, like where could the AHA pick up a vote from the court's right wing bloc? Let me ask you this, and let me kind of set up the predicate. We discussed the Trinity Lutheran decision when it was in the briefing stages. We mm-hmm. did it as a you be the Supreme Court. I was confident and confidently wrong mm-hmm. that case was going to go the opposite way. I thought it was plainly, obviously controlled by the precedent from the Washington scholarship cases. Yeah. And not only did the court come out the other way in Trinity Lutheran, but that 7-2, right?
Yeah.
That we lost from the court's left wing. There was a separate Breyer concurrence,
yeah.
and Elena Kagan joined the majority in full, right?
Yeah.
So, well, let me ask you first: Are mm-hmm. you concerned about losing any of the four justices from the court's liberal wing in this case?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's hard to say because the cases are different in their posture. I mean, one is kind of granting, I mean, we see them kind of in the same camp because, you know, we're in favor of strict separation, but, you know, there's a difference between expanding the rights of religious organizations and expanding the rights of the government. And I don't even like to call them rights, but the ability of the government to promote religion. They're kind of different sides of the same coin. So I can see a justice being in that camp, but also saying the government can't be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on a giant cross, versus the government can provide a neutral grant. You know, the language in that case, I mean, I obviously disagree with the holding, but, you know, giving, a church some funding for some tan bark or some playground material, I think is a little bit different. So to answer your question, I think Justice Breyer is someone who was asking questions about, you know, okay, this cross is really old. Can we draw a line at old monuments? He obviously wrote this controlling concurrence in the Van Orden decision involving an older Ten Commandments monument. And then on the same day, he struck one down that was a newer Ten Commandments monument. So if we do lose and we lose someone on the progressive block, I think Breyer might be the guy that that is on, you know, against us just because it's old. I think he won't accept the government's argument that it's not a Christian symbol. I think he very much recognizes it is, but I think he might say, well, it's really old, we can leave it alone, but no new monuments. And he was sort of reiterating that in the oral argument, which I think is just very arbitrary because, you know, it's people that come in that are new to the city don't know that this has been there for 100 years. And frankly, they don't care if they know that it's still there. The government's actively using it as a war memorial. Every year they meet at the base of the cross. They do a ceremony for veterans and they remind citizens that aren't Christian that they're not, you know, being honored. So I think that that to me is not a good satisfactory line drawing, but I think Breyer might be headed that direction and maybe even Kagan. I think she joins him on some of their decisions. I know she actually was the attorney arguing in favor of the war memorial cross in the Mojave Desert, but that was a situation where they'd already transferred it to private land. So she was really just saying, now that we've transferred it, it's okay. So maybe she'll be on our side, but it's hard to say. I mean, Trinity Lutheran definitely threw us all for a loop and we kind of started questioning, you know, the dividing line and feeling like fewer people are on our side than we had hoped.
Is that ultimately, because I have tried to figure out where Breyer is in the distinction on the line between Van Orden and the Kentucky, McCreary County, right? Which, as you allude to, the Supreme Court on the same day struck down one Ten Commandments monument and upheld the other.
Yeah.
And as it, you read that as Breyer essentially saying, if it's really old, it's kind of meh.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, it's not that it was just old. It was that it wasn't denominational. So the Ten Commandments are embraced by, and Justice Scalia actually talked a lot about this in his McCreary dissent, but Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, it didn't promote one religion over another. And then also it was not dominating. It was one of like 17 other monuments the same size. You could easily walk around it and not see it. You could go another direction. So there's a lot of language in that opinion that does not apply to this giant 40-foot cross that you can't avoid. It's in the main thoroughfare. It's the first thing you see when you enter the town of Bladensburg. And it does represent one religion and one religion alone. So there's a lot of things. And of course, it's dominating. It completely dominates the landscape. So I think that if Breyer's consistent with that opinion and all of those factors were equally important to him, then the age alone shouldn't matter. I think the age mattered precisely because he was saying that it was sort of a proxy for saying that people they don't really care. It's not that it was old. It was that no one had challenged it for 40 years. So to him, that was sort of evidence that it was perceived as non-religious or not, you know, overtly religious. I brought up in our oral argument that there's many reasons, and I think it's obvious to us that work in this field, that there's many, many reasons why people don't want to challenge a giant or any religious symbol in their community, especially when it's like homogenous and Christian. You know, we get death threats quite frequently, our clients do. So it's, you know, and they don't get money. It's not like there's not really a big incentive to stick your neck out and be the brave one in your community. So I think it's actually very poor evidence of something not being religious just because they took a while to take it to court.
Yeah, well, and you anticipated the question that I was going to ask next and answered it, which was, right, if that's where the weakness is, sort of how do you go about shoring up Breyer and making sure that, you know, you're not losing him in the decision. And I think that makes perfect sense, right? Like the distinctions between this case that, you know, sort of make it clear, right, that you talk about dominating the landscape and being narrowly sectarian and hopefully that outweighs the historical solemnity side of the equation.
Yeah.
Does it get frustrating to have to try to meet these people where they are? Because I think that's why I'm not a lawyer.
No, it really is.
Guys, it's a 40-foot cross. I would just be yelling the entire time.
Especially while prepping for this, because I really I buckled down for first I had to do the brief, and the brief was like a monster because it was two briefs because the government defendant had their brief, and then the American Legion got their brief, and mine was due as if I only have one brief. I got like a week long extension, which is really nothing in the legal world. So like that was a monster. And then having to prep for this thing, and I'd be, you know, spending like 12 hours, 16 hours sometimes, just like going through questions, rereading the record. And then like you just get this feeling kind of towards the end where you're like, it's a giant cross. I have to do all this yeah. work to prove to five members of the court, because that's, you know, obviously all I need, that this giant, this is a cross, and it doesn't represent Jews, and it doesn't represent anyone else, and the age of it does not change its religious character. And I feel like there's this kind of like ridiculousness that you're just like, what? How is this my life right now?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Sometimes I get,
yeah, it's just,
I think oftentimes lawyers are able to talk, you know, do really well. You know, you and Andrew are able to speak really well, like from these different arguments, like, okay, well, Breyer's thing is this, but yeah. You know, it's it. And then just, I'm glad that you said that, because sometimes I'm sitting here like, it's a 40-foot cross.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah. It's not, it shouldn't be that complicated. It shouldn't take two briefs from their side. You know, it is sad that we have to be meeting them on this term. I mean, I think that this is not the kind of case that I don't think should make it to the Supreme Court. I think a Ten Commandments might make more sense, because it is more, like I said, it's not exclusively one religion. It's obviously religious, but, you know, they've interpreted it to have some sort of secondary secular meaning. I get that. Maybe the nativity scenes that are sort of temporary. Yeah,
especially
small.
All the commandments that say, I'm the only God, right. There's no God before me, I'm a jealous God. All those ones, secular ones?
They say that because that was sort of like the first like kind of legal code, that Moses was a lawmaker and a religious leader. I mean, I can buy into the fact that it's at least more borderline, more of a gray area than an exclusively, you know, the quintessential Christian symbol, the cross. I mean, to me, this isn't the kind of case that should make it to the Supreme Court. It's these kind of like tan bark, you know, kind of a church, kind of a playground situation. Okay, I can see that being a question that's so complicated the Supreme Court might need to resolve. When it's something like this, it's just, it's obviously the reason they're taking it is either, you know, to dramatically change the law, or because they, you know, you start reading into the reasons, because the law is clear. And it should be clear. So it's really, to me, it just is an indication they want to change the law so that it doesn't strike things down like crosses and stuff.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Folks, if you've ever had to hire anybody for anything, you know that it can be a real challenge. I used to have to do some hiring. I've talked about it before, and there's nothing worse than getting that stack of resumes. You know that like 90% of them are way off. They're people who sent out just a batch of resumes to all these different positions they're not qualified for, or they haven't done a good job of actually identifying their skills, and it's a mess. And there's nothing worse than hiring somebody who isn't good enough, or being pressured to make a hire when you don't feel you have the right candidate pool in front of you. But ZipRecruiter.com/OA is where you want to go to make all of that a whole lot easier. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As the applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. And ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
It seemed to me that in both the many, many briefs that were submitted on these cases and at oral argument, that the primary case that was relied upon by the government, at least, is the Town of Greece versus Galloway decision from 2014, which... You know, refresher for our listeners, that was a 5-4 Supreme Court opinion that said it was okay for the town of Greece, which is in upstate New York, to open its legislative session with a prayer, We've had Andrew Seidel on talking about sort of the damage control that they're trying to do with respect to that decision of, you know, schools trying to open with prayer, mm-hmm. or, you know, town like city council that will have, you know, at large like student positions, mm-hmm. and, you know, and they're like, no, we just are happening to have a minister come in and stand in front of this 13-year-old and tell them that the government is Christian, right? Like that sort of thing. So bad decision. It's on the front lines. I am really curious, and this will test your oral advocacy skills here. What's the argument that this remotely should bear on giant 40-foot cross, right? Yeah. Like it seems very clear to me that those tracks have always been rather separate when you're talking about, you know, public outdoor monuments, yeah. where you pay to upkeep, you know, all of those sorts of things. So first set up the argument and then demolish it for me.
Sure. So the argument is that it's really less about Town of Greece and the holding and what the case was involving, which was legislative prayer. And more about the language that Justice Kennedy had used sort of in the middle of it, where he kind of ambiguously alludes to, he doesn't talk about Lemon, and he actually doesn't use the Lemon test, but he says any test, something to the effect of like any test the court adopts has to take this kind of longstanding history into account, that being the longstanding history of legislative prayer specifically. So he doesn't talk about Lemon at all, but they've interpreted some of the dicta in his opinion in Town of Greece to mean that there is a new test and it is a history test, and they don't define what the history test is. They just say history. And it's this complete nonsense argument that when we first started seeing it emerge in district court cases post Town of Greece, like in our cross case or in a school prayer case that had nothing to do with legislative prayer, we kind of almost, you know, relegated it to a footnote type of rebuttal, because it was so nonsense. We've never looked at legislative prayer as being in the same category as Lemon. In fact, everyone's looked at it as an exception to Lemon. But because it sort of had the snowball effect where the defendants have kind of just consistently been making Greece their primary argument, there have been one or two appellate courts that have actually picked up on it, one of which was the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that kind of said, now this is the new test. We're not sure if Lemon's overruled, but this test has to somehow get folded into Lemon. So if there is a history of a practice, we're going to look at it under Town of Greece. So it makes no sense, because the Marsh versus Chambers case was this anomaly that came out in the 80s that basically said, we're going to uphold legislative prayer because there's this long 200-year history of it. It was the first Congress that, you know, that passed the First Amendment was engaged in this practice. And so they said, how could the framers of the First Amendment pass something and then continue to do something that would be unconstitutional? Clearly the framers thought this was okay. That was the logic of Marsh. But after Marsh, they continued to play Lemon. They never applied Marsh again. Marsh was always seen as cabin to legislative prayer specifically. And so other courts that have interpreted Town of Greece in light of with Marsh in mind, have continued to say Lemon applies, Marsh is reserved, and Town of Greece are reserved for legislative prayer, and they only apply to legislative prayer. But because there's one or two circuits that have kind of alluded to it replacing Lemon, they've jumped on that and they cite it. It's kind of mind boggling because, like I said, there's nothing in that. They don't even mention Lemon. To say that it overruled Lemon is just wrong. It doesn't make sense to apply history. There's many practices that don't date back to the time of our founding fathers. I mean, if that logic applies, anything about public schools, we didn't have a public school system at the time of our founder. So it's just not helpful. It's not a helpful tool. I mean, yes, if there's specific evidence that our founding fathers were engaged in a practice, and that's debatable because Thomas Jefferson and James Madison both said that legislative prayer was not constitutional. They both disavowed doing, you know, Thanksgiving proclamations. So there was a lot of things that, who are the founding fathers? Why is it relevant what they did? Here we are 200 years later. Why does it matter? We can kind of evolve a little bit from there. So there's a lot of reasons that kind of analysis doesn't work. But I'm cautiously optimistic that they won't get rid of Lemon and replace it with this sort of very vague history test. Because one of the main criticisms of Lemon is that it's, quote, unworkable and it's too vague, and how do we know what a secular purpose is? I mean, it's a this historical analysis is far less workable, because you have to determine who the founding fathers were, what their practice was. If there wasn't a specific practice, then how the hell do we know what they would approve or not approve? I hope it doesn't go anywhere, but you never know.
Yeah. I want you to indulge me on this question, because I think this is right. I believe that that Sarah told me that you are the second youngest person ever to argue before the Supreme Court. Is that correct?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I've never heard that before, but I haven't seen anyone maybe younger than I arguing at least these kind of cases, Establishment Clause or First Amendment. But I don't know.
Having never argued before the Supreme Court, I am really, really curious on how you went about preparing for that oral argument, mm-hmm. right? I just want to live vicariously through you for a few minutes. So.
Sure. I mean, it was basically like what you would do for, you know, your appellate cases, except just like on crack, like just tenfold. Like I just basically like, I was lucky because we happened to move. I'm actually working remotely for AHA out in California because we're going to start doing our house hunting. I had a little tiny gap between two, when some briefs were due in between two cases. So I thought this was the best time to kind of move out. So we're actually living with my parents right now. I had to put the house hunting on hold, but luckily, like, because we're at home, like my parents' home, like mom's like feeding us and, you know, takes the pressure off my husband. So I basically just hunkered down in my parents' guest room and have just took out all of my books, reread the record like three or four times. It's a large record. I forget. It's like something like 4,000 pages. Reread that, kind of, you do that thing where you create hypothetical questions or questions based off the record. Some of them just completely factual, but I wanted to make sure that I had everything, every fact straight, because those are the things you can't mess up or you'll get stuck kind of talking about that too long in oral argument. So I had the whole factual thing nailed down, made myself little kind of like graphic cheat sheet charts to have in front of me just as like an aid in case they're like, what page of the record is, you know, that thing on? Just like, I know I'll never look down probably to use it, but just knowing that it's there gives you that kind of safety net. So making those things, I probably read like certain Establishment Clause cases like 5 to 10 times, depending on what. So like Van Orden, I've probably read like 15 times, but I decided to read every Supreme Court Establishment Clause case starting before the Everson case. There's like a Reynolds case and a few other early Establishment Clause cases. I wanted to read them chronologically to really get how Lemon emerges and evolves and what it was before it was Lemon and what it was after and what the real criticism is and kind of what it isn't. And so, and also just to see kind of like, I don't know, I just wanted to understand everything very chronologically. So I did that. And that also took a lot of time. I kind of skipped over some like dissents and concurrences, but I really just wanted to have like this complete, because, you know, it's an open book in the Supreme Court. I knew my opponents had eons more experience than I. So I wanted to make sure I was at least like kind of up to speed on anything that could possibly be relevant. I actually kind of taught myself a little bit more about World War I because this is, you know, World War I specific. I'm kind of embarrassing, you know, not, I really didn't know much about the World War I besides like what you learn in history class. So kind of immersed myself in some World War I documentaries and just to get the like, what was the history, looking at it from, you know, doing my own sort of independent research. We had expert reports on the use of religious symbols in World War I and the role of the Jewish Welfare Board, but really trying to understand who else was in this war besides Christians and how they were treated by different countries and how they were honored when they died, that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to have the full kind of universe. And then I tried not to do anything else that would distract me, so it all stayed in my brain.
Was it reading the cases chronologically that you sort of had that light bulb aha moment of viewing Lemon then as a synthesis of the cases that that came before it, right? Like, at what point did it sort of leap out to you to say, oh, look, these really are, it wasn't the court, you know, creating something out of whole cloth, you know, the way O'Connor was often criticized of just sort of making up balancing tests, right? But no, this is, you know, this is actually an accurate reflection of the law that came before.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I had known that, and I had written that in various briefs about Lemon being a synthesis, and they've talked about it like that. And I knew there were several cases, Shemp and a few cases in the 60s where they did have this pre-Lemon test that was, what is the purpose and what is the effect? I didn't realize the extent, like, there was other cases that we don't really cite very often that were also part of that. So we had thought there was maybe like 5 to 8 pre-Lemon cases, but there's really more like 10 to 15 that kind of applied this purpose or effect. They didn't sometimes come out and say we're applying this purpose and effect, but you look at the analysis, and they're talking, you know, in the 50s about purpose and effect. So that's really all it is. I mean, there's an entanglement prong to Lemon, but purpose and effect, getting rid of that is getting rid of a very sensible analysis. So yeah, that is kind of how the light bulb went off. It also helped me sort of see chronologically how the different justices, you know, Rehnquist was a very vocal opponent of Lemon at one point, and then he kind of backed off almost completely and joined majorities where they were like, Lemon is the test. And it was interesting just to see that, because when you just read one case and you see his criticism, you don't really see the evolution of him thinking this, then just getting over it. O'Connor, you see, I used to kind of not love her concurrences or opinions because I didn't always agree with them. You see her really trying to reconcile these sort of men on one side and men on the other. And she's like, maybe we can come up with this like middle ground. And she's trying to capture the nuances by creating those kind of reasonable observer, you know, kind of those tests that allow for complexity. And so I appreciate that. And I have a greater appreciation for that, looking at the cases more, you know, chronologically than I did reading one by one, depending on what kind of case I was arguing.
Wow. Well, that is amazing. I can imagine never, ever feeling fully 100% prepared for something like that. Like, did anything come up where you're like, ah, damn it, the one thing I didn't look up or something like that?
Not really.
Or did you cover it? Yeah. I mean, it's always, you're more worried than you should be.
Yeah. Like, the only thing was at the very end, Justice Kavanaugh asked me a question that was like really out of left field. And luckily other attorneys I spoke with after the argument were all equally like, what was that? So it wasn't like, I wasn't like alone. Cause I'm like, there was that moment where you're like, oh my God, am I really dumb? Like, am I just not getting this? And so then Sotomayor is trying to help me out. She's like, I think he's asking this. And what he was basically asking was like, kind of like, can we punt this to the Maryland legislature? And if we can punt it to the Maryland legislature, then should the Supreme Court even be resolving a case like this? And I was like, okay, my light was already red. So I'm like, I don't even know how to unpack this.
You guys granted cert, right? I didn't grant cert.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, and I part of me, because, you know, you don't know which of the justices were on the cert vote, but it was not, they kept punting it until after he was on. So I don't know if he was the key fourth vote that they needed, but exactly. I'm like, you tell me why you took this case.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I do when I'm about to argue at a circuit court of appeal is I get three of my lawyer friends together and I make them pretend to be the panel and do a mock oral argument in front of them. Did you do that before the Supreme Court argument? And if so, did you get the full nine? I'm dying to know.
Yes. Yeah, so I did actually do the Georgetown Moot Court. It's sort of like a pretty established program, and they have, you know, mock judges there. I think we actually had, I don't know why I'm not remembering this. So kind of everything up until the argument was, like I said, I was trying to keep everything in my brain. I think I had 7 justices, and they were sort of acting, as particular ones, but they didn't have like or, you know, Breyer in front of their names or anything like that. I think I had a chief justice in front of me, but they were a great panel. Everyone, I think, for the most part, was really sort of, if not explicitly, like implicitly on my side, but they were good at asking the you know, Alito kind of questions. And then I actually did a smaller one at Public Citizen. Those were both very helpful, because part of it, like the Georgetown one was great because I actually had a classroom full of students that were behind me. And so just kind of feeling that increased pressure that you would in being in a courtroom. Because even when I do like my appellate cases, there's usually like a few people, but I don't bring my clients to those. And, you know, like, I don't really know that many people in the audience. I'm way more afraid of people I know than strangers, because I don't really care what strangers think. But when you've got like your clients there and your boss and, you know, all these attorneys from all the other groups, there's like way more pressure for me. So I'm like, it kind of helped to have that feeling of, it sort of simulated what it would feel like in the courthouse.
Okay, new career idea. I'm going to really work on my Supreme Court justice impersonations and try to get a job as one of these. Yeah.
I think so far it's just I like beer.
That's all I got. Yeah.
That's great.
Okay, well, I'm cautious and respectful of the fact that you are the attorney of record in this case. And obviously, what you want for your client is for the Supreme Court to uphold the Fourth Circuit's opinion. We're all in agreement with that opinion on this podcast. But can I ask you the hard question about where you think this Supreme Court's going to go?
Yeah, sure. The optimistic side of me is saying 5-4 in our favor with kind of different reasons for upholding the Fourth Circuit's ruling. But I think perhaps more likely is a 5-4 against us, but with kind of a plurality where you've got Gorsuch and Thomas and maybe Alito kind of wanting to get rid of Lemon, and then having a majority of the court not want to get rid of Lemon, but then uphold the cross for different reasons. That's the best that I can think of in terms of us losing. I don't think that they have five justices for overturning Lemon. And that's kind of the way we're all looking at it, is wanting to preserve Lemon at this point. Yeah.
Wait a minute. I just realized I already have the perfect Clarence Thomas impression for oral arguments.
That's too easy.
I think I agree with your assessment on that. And so we have a wiki team that like records predictions. So I think your prediction is going to be that the narrow controlling opinion is going to be something that upholds the cross, but on factual specific grounds, that there will be a strongly worded concurrence from the Alito and Thomas section that is going to argue explicitly. I mean, Clarence Thomas has explicitly argued in print over and over again for an outright accommodationist view of the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. And then, you know, the court's liberal bloc in dissent. That's, we pin you down on that one?
Yeah.
Okay. It feels like, I mean, one of the things we say on the show is that, you know, there's a lot of fighting holding actions going on right now, but the only thing worse than fighting a holding action is losing a holding action. So,
yeah.
I think you're doing fantastic work. I really, really loved having you come on for this conversation. And I especially love that our ideas of preparing for oral argument are the same way, which is, well, obviously you read every single case that could potentially
You start with the Magna Carta.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't that far from there.
That's awesome. All the Federalist Papers.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. I really learned a ton from this, and fingers crossed. crosses crossed. 40-foot fingers crossed. Thanks for coming on for the main show. At least we get to keep you a little longer to find out the answer to last week's TTTBE. What do you say, Andrew?
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. Here we go with Thomas and Monica take the bar exam. This was the dreaded real property question with three parties. You have the first seller who sells a tract of land to an investor. That contract makes no mention of the quality of title to be conveyed. They complete the sale, property goes up in value, investor turns around to sell it to another buyer, and in the course of that transaction, the buyer says, hey, you don't have a marketable title here, so it's not going to convey. And then the investor goes back to sue the original seller and is suing explicitly for breach of contract. That's the key phrase here in this. And then the question is, who is likely to prevail? You both answered D, which was the original seller, because she did not expressly agree to convey marketable title. I'm sad to tell you that although the original seller will prevail, not for that reason. Oh, wow. In fact, ooh, the answer that Thomas immediately disregarded, no, C. Your first one was, yeah, well, it definitely can't be C. That is,
well, no, I said, oh, it's not answer. C, because I don't even understand it, which is why it was the correct answer to this real property question.
Yeah, this is a super obscure, and I need to tell you this, especially since we have Monica on. I often play along in my mind while reading the question. I try not to read the answers through the first time, and I would have gone with A as my answer, mm-hmm. but I would not have gotten C correct, because none of the three of us are real property lawyers. Right. So I'm confessing that here on the show. I would have also gotten it wrong. The when you unpack it, right, the doctrine of merger is what this is testing here, and you know, we all just would have gotten it wrong. The covenant that the title will be marketable is indeed implied in a contract for the sale of land, but it's the doctrine of merger that once you have conveyed the land, your action merges into the deed. Once the deed is delivered and accepted, this, as we all know, is left over from 13th century Saxony and therefore makes no sense. And so the bar guide helpfully points out the investor's remedy, if there is one, would be based on the deed he received and not on the contract of sale. So in other words, we've talked about merger that comes out in my practice every day, right? When you just have an ordinary contract will contain a merger and integration clause and say, this supersedes all of our previous agreements on this matter. Turns out real property, when you have a contract for the sale of the real property, once the deed is delivered, your cause of action merges into the deed, so you can't sue on breach of contract anymore. So there you go. We've all learned something.
Learned something new.
I think I understand this question about as much as before you explained it, which is none. What? So So the problem is it turns into a deed, and then you have to like stab the deed like it's a horcrux. I don't know. Well, I don't understand.
So when something, the doctrine of merger generally precludes you from having multiple different sources for your causes of action, right? So when Thomas, you and I are starting our scented candle business, mm-hmm. and
way ahead of you.
And right, we've discussed this at great length. We have emails going back and forth, and the emails say, you know, Thomas, you make the candles and I'll sell them. And
from Andrew Torres to Thomas, this is a stupid idea and I can't believe you keep pushing me on this. candles. Yeah, that's our
right. When you eventually talk me into it, right, we will sign. Because you will. We know that's going to happen. Yeah, that's the way the show goes.
You're just too nice.
We will sign a contract, and that contract will contain a merger and integration clause. And what it will say is, this agreement represents all the most recent discussion that we've had on this topic and supersedes all of our other previous discussions, whether written or oral. And so what that means is, suppose the contract says, we're going to split the candle revenues 50-50. But early on, you know, you proposed in an email, we're going to split it 75-25. And then I go back to that email and I try and sue in court and go, look, like the reason Thomas wore me down, like we initially went with the 50-50, but ultimately, you know, it wasn't until he promised me more money that I gave in and accepted this stupid idea. I can't go to court and do that. Right. Mm-hmm. I am prevented from introducing that evidence because it's been replaced by the written contract. That's what the doctrine of merger is. If we didn't have that clause in there, though, if it were ambiguous, then we could introduce that evidence. Right. So I guess
where I'm confused is it still sounds like D is that, but it's just C is like better than that. Like it's.
Yeah. So yeah. I will tell you, it does not. The reason D is wrong is because D says that the seller did not expressly agree to convey the marketable title, and that was in the contract. Mm-hmm. And because the contract has been superseded, it's no longer the first place that we go to try and figure out how to answer this question.
So like because it's a deed and it's 13th century Saxony, like the deed's the deed. It's just final.
The deed's the deed. That's exactly right.
Once, I guess I almost understand it, but not enough to ever answer a real property question, right?
Fortunately, you can become a lawyer and not get real property questions
Thank
right.
Thank God. All right. Well, thanks, Monica, for making me feel better about this one.
Of course. Anytime with property law.
All right, Andrew, you're going to have to hop in your time machine and tell us who this week's lucky winner is.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas and Monica, you can take solace in the fact that this question was very difficult for everyone. Lots of wrong answers on Twitter. Friend of the show, Peter Gerdes, got it right, but he used Wikipedia. So I don't think we can give him full credit for that. The first and as far as I can tell, only unassisted correct answer comes from Lucian Wang. That is at Lucian LOL on Twitter, who writes, TTTBC, the merger doctrine, aka caveat emptor. By the way, real property was one of my two favorite classes in 1L. The other was Civ Pro. Well, Lucian, I'm with you. I am a Civ Pro geek, but you have to be the first real property fan of opening arguments out there. And congratulations on getting this difficult question right, beating a Supreme Court lawyer, and being this week's winner, which obviously is the greatest benefit of all. So everyone follow Lucian Wang on Twitter, at LucienLOL on Twitter. And congratulations on being this week's winner.
Hey, Monica, make sure to throw out your plugs. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about you or your work?
Sure. They can go to AmericanHumanist.org, and you can find out more about our case on our website, which is also at AmericanHumanist.org. And
that's awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. I really did learn a lot. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And we need to thank our new patrons over on patreon.com/law. We hope you're enjoying all the goodies. It's already the end of another month, Andrew. It's coming up. So we better have a new Lot Awful Movies out for you sometime and a Q&A. Look out for the Q&A. And of course, there's still a little tiny bit of time to get your intro quotes in, right? We got another episode or so on that. So all kinds of good stuff on patreon.com/law. And I will thank, beginning with Patreon Patriot. Nice. Michael Blevins, I'm donating as much to you as my wife does to church.
Nice.
Well, for our sake, I hope she's a fundamentalist or something. Morgan T. Guard, Mike B. They're not dogs, they're alternative cats. Howard Cordingly, Greg Horning. Okay, this one I love. I can't help it. I am a child. This one is just an 8 with a bunch of equal signs and then a D.
Oh, gosh.
I can't 12. Help it. I love it.
Yeah, we're 12 on the show.
That's fine. I actually appreciate that you did that. Don Woods, Christopher Tights, and Deep State Number Station 864525A. Wow, we got the Deep State working with us. Your turn, Andrew.
All right. Thank you to Stuart Trotter, to Brett Kevin. Oh, shucks. I spilled beer on my robes. To Horns of Theseus, to David, to Medicare for All, Meat Hooks for McConnell. Like that one. Yikes. LLC for entertainment purposes. Yeah. Please redact Trump's Twitter feed. Nick, how can I be so bad at everything and still be so great, Walrath? this is a great one. Let me be from Eau Claire. I like being from Eau Claire. And I hope that person is actually from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. That would be even better. And Jeremy Majeska, thank you all so much. If you want to be read out on this list, you know how to do that. Head on over to patreon.com/law. Sign up. Give us a buck. Come on. You can give us a buck. And we'll read your Wisconsin-themed Andrew insults. How much more can you ask for?
Or your 12-year-old jokes that we still actually love.
Yes.
All right. All right, that's it for us today. Of course, you can join us for a Rapid Response Friday. I'm sure we'll get back to yodeling then. Keep up the good yodel fight. We'll see you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.